Good evening, America. Welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie and proud to do so. Boy, there's a lot on my plate since last time I hosted. You know, next time I was here, I thought I was going to get to talk about the birthers. I still may talk about them a little. I haven't had a chance to rail on them. I haven't had a chance to rail on Donald Trump, and I kind of miss that. But, yeah, there's bigger news. I admit it. We got to talk about Bin Laden. Specifically, I want to talk about why it was successful, why it is that President Obama succeeded in killing Osama bin Laden after the trail had gone cold almost 10 years after September 11th, and frankly, why President Bush did not succeed. You know, it's interesting. As I go through all of this, I know that right-wing hosts across the nation are trying somehow, some way, to attach this to George W. Bush. And Barack Obama, to his credit, did invite George W. Bush to go with him to Ground Zero. George Bush declined. Maybe it would have been a comparison he didn't want to see. But already, I mean, right-wing hosts, I've been on some of their shows. They're on all over the right-wing propaganda channels and so forth. They're saying, well, because Bush tortured people, that's why we got Osama bin Laden 8-9 years later. Well, first of all, I thought you said Bush didn't torture people. I guess now we know that was true. But we'll talk about that allegation. But specifically, I think that's entirely the wrong narrative. I think it's the wrong story to tell. We'll get into the specifics of it because the right wing's raising it, and you got to know how to answer your friends and colleagues who think that's the story to tell. That is not what this was about. This is not how we captured Osama bin Laden. We captured Osama bin Laden through something that John Kerry said in 2004 was akin to really, really good police work, investigative work. When John Kerry said that the way to capture these terrorists was to do really good police work, he was derided, he was attacked. John Kerry doesn't understand at all, this is war. Well, it is war, that's true. But it wasn't war that successfully killed the head of Al-Qaeda. We didn't capture him in battle. We didn't kill him in battle. We found a man hiding. And that's not easy to do. And we did it through some very, very creative strategy. I got to give credit to President Obama. Got to give credit to the Special Forces. Got to give credit to the military. Got to give credit to a lot of people. And it bears repeating, if only one last time, what we now know really happened to Osama bin Laden. You know, at the time of the Afghanistan war beginning, post-2001, America was so angry. I personally was extremely angry. You were too. I don't know any American that wasn't angry and sad and shocked and ready for war. I mean, I was ready for the President of the United States to get out there and ask Congress to declare war under the Constitution, the way it should be done. It was a warlike act. And while President Bush sat there reading My Pet Goat for 7 minutes, or 10 minutes, however long it was, the rest of us in America understood that this would change America forever. As I said, and I was sitting in the congressional office that day, as I said to my colleague, I said, this is already worse than Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor, of course, the day that shall live in infamy, the day that brought us into World War II. On September 11th, I was in a congressional office building. The fourth plane, the one that landed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, could very well have hit my building. They say it was headed before the Capitol, and where I was working, the Rayburn House office building was connected to the Capitol, still is, through an underground tunnel, through a subway system. And if it hadn't killed me, it likely would have killed a lot of people that I knew. If you live in Washington, D.C., to me, I'll just give my view. I think the most beautiful building in this whole town is the Capitol building. We got a lot of beautiful buildings. We got a lot of beautiful monuments. To me, there's just nothing more glorious than the United States Capitol. I just don't think any building compares in its beauty, in its majesty, in its representation of what it is, the symbol of American democracy. And when I think about that fourth plane, the idea that it would go into the Capitol dome and explode, I think that was in the Independence Day movie, right? It was horrific even then. And reality would have been a million times more horrifying. Anyway, I was in a Capitol office building almost 10 years ago. Where were you? I'm sure you remember. How could you forget? Watching when I heard the first plane hit the Twin Towers, turned on the TV, watched the second plane hit, saw the smoke at the Pentagon, heard after wondering what to do, one of my colleagues, I guess, was smart enough to immediately leave. I wasn't that smart, I admit it. I stayed there at my job till I got a knock on the door by a fellow Democrat in Martin Frost's building. He was next door to me. He, another legislative aide. I was legislative counsel to Congressman Barney Frank. And he knocked on the door and he said, "The Republicans have deserted the building." What? The Republicans have deserted the building. And it was true. All the Republican offices were empty. Apparently there had been an alert sent out among the Republicans, get out. They didn't tell us Democrats. They were the majority at the time. There were no Capitol Police. There were no alarms. All that's there now. Wasn't there then. And then we rushed to get out. My point is that wherever you were on September 11th, you remember that day. I don't have to ask you if you remember that day. I know you remember that day because you're an American. Or if you're listening to this on the web somewhere outside the United States, you care about America. And indeed, the entire world cared about us that day. 3,000 innocent Americans were dead. And within two or three days, maybe even sooner, we knew exactly who caused it. There was no doubt. It wasn't just that Osama bin Laden claimed that he did it. All fingers pointed to him. There were secret congressional briefings that pointed to him. There was no question that he and Al-Qaeda had done the event. And I wanted war. I did. I admit it. Did not support the Iraq War. Did support the Afghani War, like 90% plus of Americans. I wanted to get this guy who had caused such misery to so many people. If you're in New York, well, you're probably the only city that had it worse than Washington. And you had it much worse. Virtually everyone in New York, it seems, knows someone who was murdered that day. And, of course, the horrific sights, the firefighters, the police officers, risking their lives to save other people's lives. The horror when those towers came down. I remember watching the first one fall. I got out before the second one fell. But watching and just sinking in my stomach, didn't think that would happen. I'm reminding us of September 11th because we have now come almost full circle. No, the war's not over, but I think it's about over. I'm going to talk about that in the next 3 hours. Do you think the war in Afghanistan is over? I think it is. I'm not saying we withdraw tomorrow, but over the next year, I think we can withdraw 80-90% of our troops. We got our man. And the intelligence that was gotten in that raid should serve to pretty much finish off Al-Qaeda. Oh, there's so much to discuss. But I want to go back to what happened after September 11th. I want to talk about where the trail grew cold, the mistakes that were made at that time, and how it is that we did much better this time. Some will say, oh, Mark, you're a Democrat. You're just doing that to attack Bush and praise Obama. Well, I admit, I did not think George Bush was a particularly strong leader or good leader, and I think Obama's a much better one, though not perfect. And I'll be criticizing Obama later on tonight because I don't think he's responded to the massacres in Syria the way I'd like to see him do. But the one clear difference, it seems to me, between Bush and Obama that even Republicans might begrudgingly admit is that President Obama's a thoughtful man. He's a careful man. He's someone who weighs his options carefully, looks at all the benefits and risks before making a decision, even a very risky decision like this one, to send the SEALs in to take out Osama bin Laden. Bush prided himself on being more seat of the pants, more emotion. And I got to tell you, sometimes I want that. I remember after September 11th listening to George Bush say, we're going to capture Osama bin Laden dead or alive. And I said, right on. And I said, right on, even though I knew that the American people elected Gore in 2000, even though I knew that constitutionally Gore was supposed to be our president and the Supreme Court had stolen the election, I knew that. I had written the brief challenging the Florida electors personally. I was angry about it, but it didn't matter. At that moment, I was glad to hear our president say, in an emotional way, we're going to get this guy. We're going to get this bastard. We're going to get this murderer. And he was right. At least emotionally, right? But he wasn't thoughtful. He wasn't careful. And there's a wonderful article that I really, when we're done tonight, I really am going to advise you to read. It's in today's newspaper, Friday, May 6th, in the Washington Post. The Washington Post gives details of how we lost Osama bin Laden the first time and why we got him the next time. And these are details that we didn't know in October, November, and December 2001, when we were losing bin Laden. It only came later. I remember watching a 60 Minutes with Gary Bernson, the CIA chief at the time, talking only years later about how we let bin Laden escape our grasp. And it's important to say, not just because I'm really not trying to make political points here. You may not believe me. That's okay. But to understand for the future how we should approach these things. Because one way is all movies, right? A president is shocked, doesn't know what to do. He'll keep reading to the kids because he's scared. I'm surprised he didn't hide under his desk. And then he says, I'll get him. Like a 10-year-old prince with his scepter. I'll get him, daddy, I'll get him. And we torture people, and we go out, and we go and we invade another country, Iraq. We'll get to that. Versus a very careful president. And I admit, sometimes Barack Obama's too careful. Sometimes he's too calm. Sometimes he's too cool. Sometimes I want to hear that emotion. I've got a lot more emotion than Barack Obama. But there are times when you've got to be careful. Just the fact he brought an extra helicopter in case something happened to one, and gosh, one did crash. So when we come back, I want to talk about Tora Bora. I want to talk about that mountain outpost on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border where we lost Osama bin Laden. I want to talk about why we did and how the Obama administration did better. Give me a call. Let me know what you think. 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine, back after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. Trying to figure out what happened. I mean, why did it take us so long to get Osama bin Laden? What did we do wrong? And then what later did we do right? If you watched, like I did, a 60-minute episode back, I think, in 2004, 2005, you saw Gary Bernson. He was the CIA chief. He was his job to get bin Laden. And he got so angry at the government's failure to help him that he came on 60 Minutes as a whistleblower to talk about it. Now, it's pretty rare that you see a CIA guy quit his job to tell Americans what happened. He must have been pretty upset. And it's understandably so. So he's the CIA chief in the region. He's the main guy in Afghanistan. He's the head of our Afghan team. It's his job to get Osama bin Laden. And he knows that Osama bin Laden is trapped in this mountain complex of Tora Bora. And he was told at the time, we can't afford troops to fight the war in Afghanistan. How ironic is that? The same president that sent 100,000 troops to Iraq. Bernson asked his superiors for 800 Army Rangers. They said he was in Tora Bora, he was stuck in the mountains, and if he had 800, not 8,000, not 80,000, not 800,000, 800 Army Rangers between bin Laden and the border, Bernson was confident he could capture him. Now, you know, he must have asked for more than he needed because, you know, to have that level of confidence. He wrote to his superiors. By the way, this is from today's Washington Post article, which I highly recommend reading because it takes all these things that I heard. I heard some of them in Congress. I heard some of them on 60 Minutes. I heard them over all the years. He puts it all together in one place and tells a really carefully written story. Most of it is not new to me, but it puts it all together, and I highly recommend you reading it. So Bin Laden's trapped. He's gone deep into the mountains. He's in Tora Bora. Bernsen wants 800 Army Rangers. He's told no. He's told no. They're going to rely on Afghanis. So he actually recruits an Afghani because he knows that Bin Laden's in desperate shape. He actually recruits a young Afghani, pays him to go into the mountains and, and to offer Bin Laden and his followers food and water. And the guy comes back to Bernsen a few days later and says, Bin Laden's there. We had a positive ID on the guy. So what do? We couldn't get the individuals to go in. We carpet bombed the place. We sent in a huge bunker buster bomb. We vaporized people in those mountains, and I'm not saying I feel sorry for them. I'm glad the Al-Qaeda people are dead. But Bin Laden got away. And he got away, interestingly, not by crossing the Pakistani border. This is something I didn't know. He didn't cross the Pakistani border through the mountains, which must have been very difficult to do. No, he actually slipped past the very thin American line to the town of Jalalabad and then even took horseback into the Konar province. That was new to me. What's fascinating about this account, though, and again, this is nothing new. This is something Gary Bernsen's talked about, is why U.S. officials were so reluctant to help him. I'll give you that part of it when we come back. This is Mark Levine, 888-653-7543. Welcome back to Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie and telling what George Bush did wrong, what the United States did wrong, how we lost Osama bin Laden is at least as interesting, I think, as how we got him. We'll talk both sides of the story tonight. You've probably been focusing a lot on how we got him. We will discuss that, I promise. But right now I want to talk about how we lost him, because I think it gives insight into mistakes that should not be made again. So as I said, when Osama bin Laden was trapped at Tora Bora, and Gary Bernsen, the CIA chief there, was begging U.S. officials to allow him to have 800 troops to help him out, U.S. officials were reluctant to send in troops. They told Gary Bernsen and other officers that the Pakistani troops would help them, and they'd cut off bin Laden if he tried to enter the country. President Pervez Musharraf, the then dictator of Pakistan, said he didn't want to commit troops unless the Americans would help transport them to the border by air. He wanted air support. But according to the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, this is Bush's ambassador to Pakistan, a woman by the name of Wendy Chamberlain, Musharraf told her and General Tommy Franks, so we have a witness. General Tommy Franks was the commander of the whole U.S. Central Command there in Afghanistan. He said, Musharraf, the head of Pakistan, said, quote, I'd put the troops in trucks, but that'll take weeks. Can you give me air support? Chamberlain learned, after Franks was noncommittal about air support, our general. She later learned that that general, Tommy Franks, was, quote, already planning for Iraq, unquote. She said, quote, even if he could have helped out, he was already starting to have to reshuffle, unquote. This is Bush's ambassador to Pakistan. Franks is a witness. He has declined to comment. But without the air support, the Pakistanis did not have enough troops sent to the border. There was another plan, because the special ops, you know, one of the best things a president can do is let the smart people who spend their whole lives studying this thing, let them act. Remember when Bush used to say, I let the generals decide? Well, sometimes it's not about the generals. Sometimes it's about the men in the field, the special ops, the really smart men and women who are trained to take it down. I mean, that's what they do. They spend their whole lives focusing on taking down these high targets. And what did the special ops say? Well, there's a guy, the head of the special ops at the time, He went under the pseudonym. We don't know his real name. His pseudonym is Dalton Fury. He had a plan. He said the Afghanis wouldn't be able to do their job. He didn't trust them to do it. And so he had an idea to go in the back way. It's kind of a clever military plan, right? It worked for the Nazis in the Maginot Line. It worked for Lawrence of Arabia. It, you know, surprised them from the back. They crawl through Pakistan. They'd have to climb up a 14,000-foot peak. It required oxygen. It was no doubt. It was a pretty risky plan, no question about it. But he knew the Afghani fighters just wouldn't do it. He knew. He'd been there. He knew the Pakistani forces just wouldn't do that. And his superiors told him, don't go in from the back. We should, quote, align our mission with the Afghan Mujahideen to put an Afghan face on killing bin Laden, unquote. Now, let me tell you something. I'm all for putting a face. I'm all for example, in Libya, letting the people of Libya take down Gaddafi, although they may need our help. We can talk about that in hours to come. But you know what? Bin Laden attacked us. Gaddafi kills his own people. He's horrible. That's terrible. Bin Laden attacked us. We had every right to go after him ourselves. And Fury, this special ops head, said, quote, the Mujahideen were not very skilled or motivated fighters, but he followed orders, as he must. He stayed on the Afghan side of the border, and then he got a tip on December 10th from a source who claimed to know bin Laden's location. 30 members of his team launched a hasty assault. They ran up there. They had to get him while he could, but some of them were abandoned by their Afghan allies behind enemy lines. The men halted their advance and spent 2 hours rescuing their Afghan mates. Fury aborted the mission. This is all from today's Washington Post article. Again, compare to Barack Obama, who did not alert the Pakistanis, who said, in fact, running for election, that he, if he had actionable intelligence, he would go into Pakistan and get Osama bin Laden. You remember John McCain said, that's horrible. You can't do that. You can't go into a sovereign nation and get the guy that murdered 3,000 Americans and Barack Obama said, I beg to differ. We have every right, and we do. We have every legal right under international law, under the laws of self-defense, under the United Nations Charter. We have every legal right to go in when the authorities aren't doing the job. And gosh knows, the Pakistanis had Osama bin Laden in that compound for 5 years and hadn't arrested him. Obama knew not to alert the Pakistanis. So bin Laden gets away. He goes to Jalalabad. He takes horseback to another route. But it turns out that in 2006, there's another account. Now, this is something I didn't know. I knew about Bernsen's account. I knew about the special ops. That's something that's been written about before. Here's something I didn't know. I learned in the Washington Post today. Lieutenant General John Vines told the Washington Post in 2006 that the drones that the U.S. forces depended on were supposed to track Osama bin Laden were redeployed to be made available for the Iraq War. Once Vine's troops believed they were within a half an hour of catching up to bin Laden, the general called for 3 drones to bomb and or at least cover 3 possible escape routes. But only 1 drone was available. The others had been moved to Iraq. The target got away. George Bush wasn't focused on Afghanistan. He never was. He had always planned to invade Iraq. We know, in fact, from The Price of Loyalty, from that book by Ron Susskind, that his former Treasury Secretary talked about a secret meeting on January 30th, 2001, 10 days after George Bush takes office, where he and a bunch of military and Dick Cheney and other guys are sitting around dividing up Iraqi oil fields. No, Iraq was well planned for. Got to get that oil. That didn't work out either. But Afghanistan, that was a real surprise. In fact, some, and I believe Cheney was on this team, was arguing invade Iraq first, even though Iraq didn't attack us. But what's clear as we learn, as we go through the details, that exactly what Barack Obama said in the election was true. Because of Iraq, we got hurt in Afghanistan. Because George Bush took men and materials away from the effort in Afghanistan to fight in Iraq, Osama bin Laden got away. Eric from Minneapolis, are you there?
Oh, Mark.
Hey, thanks for calling in. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, first, you know, a couple of things. One, you answered your own question about why Obama got him. I mean, Obama, he knows that if they ask Pakistan, those SEALs would have just, you know, gone into an empty house.
Yep.
You know, Obama just says, you know, forget that. He's ours.
He knew we couldn't trust him.
That's right. You can keep the house. And, you know, secondly, you know, I can empathize with, you know, wanting Obama to be more strong all the time. But if you notice, Obama, along with Democrats, they don't run their mouths off constantly. But when they do, they come off the top rope.
The top rope?
You know, yeah.
Meaning they've actually done something worthy of running their mouths about.
Yeah, like when Democrats finally stand up and get tough like people want them to, it's they've done something.
Yeah, well, and he certainly had. He certainly had. You know, sometimes, and the thing I like about is George Bush must have given 10 speeches, 20, 30 speeches. We're going to get him. We're going to get him dead or alive. We're going to get him. Mission accomplished. They're in the last throes, I think Dick Cheney famously said, of the Iraqi resistance. You know, the end is around the corner. Obama said he was going to do it in the campaign, and then he quietly set about doing it, and as you say, he didn't crow about it until after it was done.
Yeah,
and he didn't crow about it. I mean, the fact that he didn't release the pictures because he recognizes that could harm us in the future.
Totally. You know, that would just stir the pot.
Exactly.
This dude was shot in the eye with a scar H.
Right.
You know, it's like if you know that gun, you know what kind of damage that would do.
And the pictures would have been all over everywhere. They would have inflamed everyone. The one thing I guess I slightly disagree with the president on is I think he should have shown the pictures to a few trusted media people, maybe one person from CBS, ABC, NBC. You know, say it, show them to Brian Williams, show them to Katie Couric, one person from each media so that no one thinks we're trying to hide anything, so to admit that it's done. But I agree with not to publicize
it. No, it wouldn't have mattered. They would have said it was doctored. I mean, Obama landed the chopper, come out guns blazing by himself, dragged the body back, and Republicans still would have said there was something wrong with it.
Well, that's how it works in the movies, Eric. That's exactly how it works in the movies. Hey, stick around with me if you want. I got to take a break, but I want to continue to talk about this story, about what happened under Bush and how it was different under Obama. Feel free to stay if you like, or if you're done, hang up. And others can join us at 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. It seems like ages ago, doesn't it? I mean, it was almost 10 years ago. September 11th occurred. Remember all the debates after that time? Both Democrats and Republicans wanted to go to war. That's true. But there were real differences about what to do after we conquered Afghanistan, after we got rid of the Taliban. We were there, 6 months, 9 months, and already the president was talking about Iraq, which of course had zero connection to Al-Qaeda. One of the reasons, by the way, why Iraq was justified was because Vice President Cheney said that one of Al-Qaeda's main men, Al-Libi, had talked about meeting with Saddam Hussein in Prague, the Czechoslovakia. I think it was still Czechoslovakia then. May have been the Czech Republic. Remember that lie? Do you know where Cheney got that lie? He got that lie because Al-Libi was tortured, and like most people who are tortured, lied. So we torture a guy, a bad guy. He lies. And how many Americans died? How many Iraqis died? How many people are without limbs? How many brave American men and women? Now, to be fair, I don't think anyone rightly believes Dick Cheney when he said we went into Iraq because this one guy was tortured to give some false information. That was just his excuse. As I said, if you read The Price of Loyalty, you know that Bush's own Treasury Secretary reports on a meeting, and he even shows the document. So this meeting is undisputed. He has the actual document marked secret by the CIA that they accidentally released and then tried to get back, showing the Iraqi oil fields where they're dividing. The British get this, and the French get this, and the American oil companies get this. The war in Iraq was long planned. It was planned while Clinton was president. But the argument was, we got to go after Saddam Hussein because of 9/11, because Osama bin Laden killed us, therefore we have to invade Iraq. And in the anger of the moment, a lot of Americans didn't concentrate on one Middle Eastern country versus another, on one bad guy versus another, on the guy that masterminded 3,000 American deaths, and a supremely bad guy that had not done so. And what's interesting is that when Democrats, I remember the election 2004 when John Kerry said the best way to get bin Laden is police work, painstaking tasks, put together the clues, look at the satellites, find out who are bin Laden's associates. We need more human intelligence. We need people on the ground. We can't just go bomb things. Not that he's against bombing things, but we got to know who we're bombing. And the Republicans said, Kerry, this is war. You, I won't use the word on air. Begins with a P. Ends with a Y. You wimp. Police work. Ha! And yet it was police work that got bin Laden. Detailed. Figuring it out. Who he communicated with, after all. The reason we caught him at Tora Bora is because he was using a cell phone. He got smart. He was not a dumb man, Osama bin Laden. Evil, no doubt, but not dumb. He stopped using the cell phones. He stopped using the internet. He started using only trusted couriers. And we found out the description of that courier. Interestingly, the first guy to give us a description of the courier was not waterboarded. We had waterboarded two people, colleague Sheikh Mohammed and Al Libby. They lied to us about this courier. But a guy who wasn't waterboarded and cooperated pretty quickly with us, Ghul was his name, G-H-U-L, he told us. He gave us a description, and then we had to follow him. We set up a safe house in Pakistan. We didn't tell Pakistan about it. Barack Obama was very careful. You know, he knew about this compound as early as August of 2010. Now think back to August of 2010. Think about September. Think about October. What was going on then? Everyone was focused on the elections. The Republicans were riding high. Everyone said it would be a rout. The Republicans, because of anti-Obama rhetoric, they were going to win 50, 60, 70 House seats and several Senate seats. And lo and behold, they did. Now, if we had a president that cared more about politics than he did about capturing the guy that murdered 3,000 Americans, he probably would have raided that compound in August, September, or October. It would have been a great political thing. He could have done it in October, a nice little October surprise, right? His numbers would have skyrocketed. The Democrats would have done better in the election. One could argue politically it was the right thing to do. But that's not how our president operates, is it? Now, our president knew to be careful, to take his time, to set up a safe house, to watch who went in and out of that house, and to be absolutely sure he was right. Now analysts were not just bombing willy-nilly. They were reading books, even a book that I have. I got as a present, Growing Up Bin Laden, by one of the terrorists' wives and son, just talking about that he kept a safe house in Kabul. Okay. That's interesting. He thought Americans wouldn't go where there are a bunch of civilians. That was part of the clue. I'm going to talk about more about the clues when I come back at the top of the hour. Before I go there, though, I do want to check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria Jones is here. And we're going to talk about this later on in the hour, so I'm going to get to this too. But they're talking about Medicare reform. The Republicans, as you know, had always said that under the Ryan plan, they were going to end Medicare. That Medicare was done. No more anymore. We'll give old people a coupon and good luck. But now they apparently are backing off that stance. Is that right, Victoria?
Well, they appeared to be when Representative Dave Camp, who's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, which, as you know, is probably the most powerful committee in the House,
sure, said that it controls the money.
Said he was not going to allow changes to the plan to come through his committee. And the House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said earlier in the week that the president had excoriated the plan so much that it was basically, you know, useless. But then now they've sort of bitten back, saying today the media's created a false narrative of retreat, and that they will continue to advocate for the plan. In fact, GOP leadership this afternoon issued a statement of support saying that we're united in our approach, and we're committed to our budget, making reforms necessary to grow our economy, create jobs, preserve and strengthen Medicare, not end it, and put our nation, I added that bit, and
well,
put
no,
our
but
nation
Victoria,
on the path to pay down the debt.
It sounds like they're between a rock and a tea party. It sounds to me like here, and of course I'm paraphrasing rock in a hard place. I mean, here's a case where they already voted for a plan, and Paul Ryan's plan is quite clear. It will end Medicare. It's going to, it only ends it for people who are 55 and lower, but it ends it. You get a coupon, and it gives a lot of money to the insurance companies. They get to raise their rates as high as they want, and instead of it being paid for by the government, you got to pay the vast majority of it yourself. They all voted for this plan. I don't know how they thought they would get away from this narrative anyway, and now that they tried to, the Tea Party said, yeah, we want to end Medicare. I mean, it sounds to me like Eric Cantor doesn't know whether he's coming or going.
Well, I think they may have got themselves into a bit of a hole, and you're saying exactly what Senator Chuck Schumer said, which was that basically you're not running away from the narrative. I'm paraphrasing him. We're not going to let you run away from the narrative.
Well, and now they're not. I mean, that's why they're stuck, because first they vote to end Medicare, then they deny having voted to end Medicare, and then the Democrats say, what do you mean? Here it is. Here's your vote to end Medicare. And they say, okay, fine, we are ending Medicare because the Tea Party wants us to end Medicare. I mean, what they really are is they're stuck because the vast majority of Americans like Medicare. Most recent polls show that 94% of Americans on Medicare approve of Medicare. So it's just very unpopular what they're trying to do. Victoria Jones, thank you very much for giving us that little insight there. I always appreciate when Talk Radio News Service comes on the air. We'll be right back with more of the Bin Laden story and how it is that Osama was captured by Obama. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine filling in, talking about why we got Bin Laden. Now, it's easy to celebrate. It's fine to celebrate. I got no problem with celebrations. I think the people that don't want the celebrations, well, I understand the guy's dead, but you know what? There's certain people, not many. There's certain people that it's okay to celebrate when they're dead. I'm sure many people celebrated when they learned Hitler was dead. It's fine to celebrate Osama bin Laden's death. You may disagree with me. Hey, if you disagree, call in. That's what it's all about. 888-653-7543. I agree that there should be a bit of somberness. I think actually Barack Obama has shown exactly the right tone. But for Americans to cheer in the street, that is fine. That is just fine. I mean, look at the cheering we did at VJ Day, right? Victory over Japan. No, that was the end of a long war, World War II. Though, World War II, let's face it, it's only about half as long as the war in Afghanistan. Obviously, a lot more deaths and destruction, American deaths, and, of course, millions and millions of innocent people. But we got victory there right after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right after we dropped two nuclear bombs on civilian populations. And I'm not trying to go there. That's a argument, historical argument for another day. My point is that if there was any time to be somber, it was then. But you can understand, people are glad the war was over. And I think the war in Afghanistan is just about over. I think that the great intelligence that we captured, and we're going to talk about why it is that Barack Obama decided to send people in, individuals in, a much more risky element than simply bombing that compound. One of the reasons is to get those treasure troves of intelligence. And I suspect over the next 6 to 9 months, we're going to be chasing down a lot of leads. A lot of leads that have grown cold. And we're going to get a lot of these bad guys. And we can be resolute about it. I don't know if you saw that picture of Obama in the Situation Room. He seemed awfully resolute. But there's no reason we can't be happy about it. when George Bush said mission accomplished, there was no mission accomplished. But I'd say the mission's been accomplished here, and it's continuing to be accomplished. And the reason it was accomplished, because this was a president that didn't give up, that understood it was slow, painstaking work. I want to read to you, again, this is from today's Washington Post article, talking about the search under the last administration. Said a former Bush White House official, a little fatigue had set in, quote unquote. There was slow, painstaking work analyzing the data, and the White House was impatient. Quote, we weren't about to find him anytime soon. Publicly, we maintained a sense of urgency. We're looking as hard as we can, we said. But the energy had gone out of the hunt. It was settled to no more than a second-tier issue. After all, those were the worst days of Iraq. Unquote. That's a direct quote of a Bush White House official quoted in today's Washington Post. Let's face it. George Bush decided to take us from one mess to two mess. From one mess that we didn't start to a mess that we did start. It's kind of like getting stung by a bee, and instead of spraying the hive, getting out, getting angry, and just banging the hive with a big stick until you break two hives and more bees come loose. We were focused on Iraq. We were focused on North Korea. Well, okay. North Korea, it's not something we caused. But the search for bin Laden, once the clarion cry, this is Washington Post, once the clarion cry of a nation bent on striking back morphed into a topic Bush and his top staffers sought to avoid. It was just a hope that we would find him, said Juan Zarate, Bush's deputy national security advisor for counterterrorism. It was just a hope that we'd find him. It was a very dark period, quote unquote. I'm not making this up. Washington Post isn't making this up. These are Bush White House officials telling us that in the Bush White House, the lack of credible leads led to public statements designed to play down the individual and focus attention on the broader threat. Zarate said, quote, the idea was not to overly aggrandize the man, even as we tried to find him. But I can't remember any single specific piece of intelligence that got us especially excited, Zarate said. It was a dark time. Let's face it, the president messed up. He lost public enemy number one in Tora Bora because he was focused on Iraq and not on Afghanistan. Now, look, I don't think Bush did this on purpose. That's ridiculous. That's for conspiracy theorists. I don't think Bush intentionally let Osama bin Laden go. No. But he was negligent. He had his eye on another prize. His prize was Iraq. And those of us who opposed the Iraq war and supported the Afghanistan war, as I did, as most, frankly, the Democratic Party did, were saying, you're taking your eye off the ball. Saddam Hussein's a bad guy, that's to be sure, but we've just been attacked by Osama bin Laden. 3,000 Americans are... The dirt is fresh over their graves. Mr. President, we didn't elect you. The American people chose Gore. Remember, you lost that election in 2000, but you got in unconstitutionally through your own coup d'etat. Okay, you have about as much authority over the United States as the dictator of Pakistan, President Musharraf, but we got to depend on both of you. Neither of you won an election. Neither of you were constitutionally the president of your countries, but Bush and Musharraf, you were our only hope. And you let us down. I remember thinking Al Gore wouldn't have done that. Remember boring Al Gore? Careful Al Gore? Someone who was the technocrat? Someone who read all the briefings? Remember when Bill Clinton, his national security advisor, told Condoleezza Rice, told the Bush administration officials, that's the guy you got to watch for, bin Laden. And they didn't want to do what Clinton said because it was Clinton that said it. Clinton was bad. Clinton had cheated on his wife. So they were going to do it their own way. So they didn't even have a hearing on the question of bin Laden determined to attack the United States, which was the name of the briefing that Condoleezza Rice finally had in August of 2001, some 8 months after Bush had been selected by the Supreme Court to be president of the United States. This was Clinton's idea. They couldn't follow that. They were into politics. They were into oil companies. Okay, they weren't focused before September 11th. All right. But none of us expected that to happen. I mean, I didn't. Of course, it wasn't my job to expect that to happen. People who knew, Richard Clark knew. He expected it to happen. He was warning. But okay, fine. After it happened, I was on alert. All of America was on alert. We couldn't afford 800 soldiers? Could someone who supported the war in Iraq please explain to me why we could afford 80,000 soldiers in Iraq, but we couldn't afford 800 soldiers to capture bin Laden? Will they answer that question? No, they're going to talk about, torture helped. It didn't help. They want to change the subject. They want to change the narrative. That's why all the right-wing radio stations, that's why all the right-wing TV networks are all going on about whether or not torture helped, because they know Bush supports torture, and they want to argue that we need to torture, and they want to just change that narrative. We'll go there. I'll answer their narrative. Let's talk about the more important question first, not whether out of the thousands of pieces of information that were put together, a couple tidbits came from torture that may or may not have come from torture. The question is, why did Bush fail and Osama was captured by Obama? Why did Obama succeed and Bush fail? Why? Because Bush wasn't focused. Now, that shouldn't surprise you. You know President Bush. You remember President Bush. You know President Obama. One rules with the gut, right? The other rules with the careful thinking. And some would argue Obama's too careful and too unemotional and too cool. And maybe sometimes he is. I've criticized him for that. But capturing bin Laden was not a game of shooting gallery. It was a game of chess. Three-dimensional chess at that. You know, Bush may well be a better shot than Obama. You know, if there's a target out there, I wouldn't be surprised if George Bush hits that target more often than Obama does. But I'll bet you Obama could beat Bush in a game of chess. Bush thought that shooting at bin Laden was like shooting at a shooting gallery. Obama thought it was a chess game. Obama was right. We heard all the time, we'll just kill him. We'll just kill him. We'll just shoot them all. Look, we killed number three, number five. We killed 133 people in Al-Qaeda. And by killing them and by torturing people, not just the bad guys, we tortured people at Abu Ghraib. We tortured innocent people, too. Maher Arar was a guy who got on the wrong plane and got sent to Syria and was brutally beaten there at our directive. What about him? On all the discussion of torture, what about the innocent people we tortured, George Bush? Did they give information that led to bin Laden? I don't think so. We committed war crimes. We violated the Constitution of the United States. George Bush personally violated the Constitution of the United States. You want to talk about an impeachable offense? Talk about war crimes. Talk about violating the Geneva Conventions, a treaty. You know what? If you believe in torture, and we can have a whole philosophical discussion over whether it works or not. I've had them before. If you believe in torture, then at least do it legally. Do what Alan Dershowitz says. Have Congress pass the law that allows torture, and have the president sign an executive order. I hereby authorize the torture of A, B, and C. It's a democracy. If we're gonna stand for torture, let's stand publicly for torture. Oh, no, that would harm the war effort. Well, you know what? Real torture of innocent people, when we deny it, harms the war effort more because more people become terrorists. Here's the cool thing about bin Laden. By the time we killed him, he was no hero in the Arab world by very, very few. Hamas likes him, right? That's no surprise. The terrorists in Gaza like him. Okay, that's to be expected. The terrorists in Lebanon like him. Hezbollah. but the ordinary Arab people, they're too busy fighting for their own freedoms against their own dictators in Egypt and Tunisia and Syria and Libya and Yemen, Bahrain. They got their own dictators to deal with, and they've learned that they can get more power by peacefully demonstrating and dying for their cause than by killing a bunch of civilians. I wish Hamas would learn that. Right? They're all out to destroy Israel, to kill all the Israeli civilians. They just bombed a school bus, killed a 16-year-old boy. That was really good for the Palestinian cause. That's Bin Laden's way. It's the losing way. Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela all knew that through nonviolence you can achieve amazing things. But violence just gets you Bin Laden, gets you death. And it's appropriate. It's appropriate. The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. Want to hear your comments on anything I've said or anything about Bush, Obama, Bin Laden, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq? What are your thoughts? Let me know. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back after this. Well, we got Osama Bin Laden. One of the callers earlier, Eric, made a good point. He talked about crowing on victory, that Republicans, you know, Bush crowed a lot. You know, mission accomplished, right? I mean, you know about that banner, right? The boat was not way out at sea. It was a few miles off the coast of California. In fact, Bush had the boat turned around because he didn't want anyone to see the California shore, so it would look like it was out to sea. They put up the big thing, the big sign. He has mission accomplished. He has all these people cheer him. Obama's been exactly the opposite. He has said when he went to Ground Zero, he didn't stand on a mound with the megaphone, you know, look at what we did. This is he could have. He had, in fact, by every right, he had the right to. If anyone deserved to stand at Ground Zero and crow with a megaphone and said, I promise you, we get him and we got him, to cheers and applause, he could have done it. Many a president would have done it. If anything, like I said, he deserved to crow, whereas Bush did not. And yet it's exactly the opposite. Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. Obama did what he had to do and didn't cry and scream and brag about it. Vice President Biden, who's certainly known to be talkative, quietly laid a wreath at the Pentagon. They had dignity. Now, you know, I like a rah-rah president as much as the next guy. In fact, I think sometimes Obama's coolness turns a lot of people off, but somehow Obama recognized, yes, it's a big day. No, the war's not over, though I'm going to talk later on about why I think this actually means the war is ending. These are my words, not Obama's words. But this was still a tragic day, a tragic remembrance. Getting justice for the 3,000 victims September 11th doesn't bring them back, doesn't give their lives back to their families. It just gives a mere little bit of comfort, a little bit of solace, a little bit of understanding that this bad, evil doer is not out there continuing to plot to kill Americans. It's not just justice for the past. It's protection for the future. And I got to give our president a lot of credit. He stood his cool. He didn't crow about it. He came on the Sunday night, right? 10:30 p.m. Turns out 50 million Americans watched anyway. And before he even came on the air, what did he do? He called everybody. He called the Pakistani president and said, hey, you know, we were just in your airspace. Thought you'd like to know. He called George W. Bush. He called members of Congress. He alerted everyone to what was going on. He did his responsible duties. You know, there's one guy writes on Facebook on Leslie's page that, and I call him an Obama hater because he won't even call the president President Obama. He says Barry, right, using Barack Obama's childhood nickname as a way to, I guess, put him down. Barry just wants to take credit. It's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. Bush took credit for things he didn't do. And Barack Obama treated with dignity the great job he did do. I know some of you are on the phone. I will get to you when we come back, I promise. Stay on the line and join us. 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. This is Mark Levine talking about Bin Laden, why Obama was successful and George Bush was not, and why it was good to focus on Afghanistan instead of Iraq, why that was the proper focus. Later on in the hour, I'm going to talk about the right-wing argument that torture saved the day. I guess they're trying to really rally that torture become an American value, and so they're trying to argue it was. I don't think it did in this case. We may never know for sure. But it seems to me the evidence is against the fact that torture helped, and in fact it probably hurt. We'll get to that. And also we'll get to the question later on about whether this means it's time to leave Afghanistan, because I think it is. If you want to call in on any of those questions, toll-free number is 888-653-7543. William from Chicago, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome.
Yeah, I'm here.
So what are your thoughts? Why did Obama succeed where Bush did not? Or maybe you disagree with that theory.
I'll preface this by saying I am a conservative.
Okay.
But the comment that I made was snakes hide under many rocks. And sometimes it takes time to lift the rocks all up to get to the snake.
That's true.
I think some of the willingness to hide Bin Laden in plain sight deteriorated for one reason or another. And I do think Bush, while he was in office, set an aggressive tempo for pursuit and got many of the main cards, but he did not get the ace. And to his credit, President Obama seems to have allowed the pursuit by the intelligence community to continue. And I will agree with you that it was quiet and understated. But he was the man in charge when they found him. And I think whether you're on the right or left, but most of the people I've heard on the right give him full credit for being the man in charge, making the active decision, and taking him out. So I give him full credit for that.
I'm glad to hear that, because I've heard otherwise by some conservatives, including some that have posted on Facebook. So I'm glad to hear you say that. Go ahead.
Yep, that's my position on it. The only other comment I'll make is I do disagree with you with the stand and crowing comment. I don't think most people felt Bush was crowing when he was inspiring Americans during probably one of the most tragic moments we've had in our history. And I think most people, again, on the right and on the left, I remember quite a few left pundits, left-wing followers, who thought that talk was inspirational, and I would agree with that.
Well, let me ask you this, William.
Words at the right moment.
I tell you, I don't complain as much about the Ground Zero moment with Bush as I do about the mission accomplished, because I think that was a case where the mission was not accomplished, where he had taken our eye off the ball. And one of the interesting things about the Washington Post article, which I read in detail over the last hour, today's Washington Post, is it talks about all the many times that we had a chance to get Osama bin Laden, not just at Tora Bora, although that was the main one, but subsequently, and because of the war in Iraq, taking all our resources, taking all our time, taking all our focus, taking all our attention, we took our eye off the ball. And I don't know whether you supported the war in Iraq or not, but I would hope that even if you did support the war in Iraq, you could agree with me that the war in Afghanistan was more important, that Iraq hadn't attacked us, that it should have been the number one concern of the president to get Osama bin Laden, and number two or three or four to get Saddam Hussein.
Well, I fully support the war on terror, wherever that takes us. I didn't support a land action in Iraq once we uncovered the president of Iraq. Once we got him out of action and pulled him up out of the hole, at that point, as far as I'm concerned, we could have left the country, and a lot of people agree with that. I have no interest in nation building anywhere.
Well, let me ask you that as a segue to my next question.
Terrorists wherever they are.
Well, I have no problem with that either. And I listen, when I say, and it's a nice segue to my next point, I think it's time to pull out of Afghanistan. But when I say pull out, I don't mean remove every last soldier. I mean pull out maybe 80, 90% of our troops. I mean, we don't have to occupy every town and hamlet and little village and try to build every bridge and even help every girl go to school. It's a wonderful idea, but we've got needs at home, and frankly, we have needs abroad too. Frankly, I think preventing a Libyan massacre is more important than helping an Afghani girl go to school. But I'm not saying give up. If we know, if we have actionable intelligence, as the president said, whether it's in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Iraq, Syria, Iran, you name it, if we have actionable intelligence of some terrorist group, I want to take them out. But what I think President Obama showed is that a small group of well-trained men and women, our SEALs, are more than competent enough to do that without us having to occupy an entire country.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you on that one.
Okay. So do you think now that we've killed bin Laden, it's time to start to wind down the Afghanistan war?
Absolutely. And I don't know that they're necessarily related one to the other. Again, I'm not a fan of nation building, particularly in an area that I think is tribal oriented. And we use words like liberty and that sort of thing for our overseas Middle Eastern friends. But we've got a constitution right here in America. Anyone can copy it, and I don't see anybody moving towards it. So I'm not a fan of supporting one tribal-oriented head over another tribal-oriented head. But I do believe we should have a stick so powerful that if you harm a hair on an American's head, there's an incredibly high price to pay for it.
You know, William, you may be a conservative and I'm a liberal, but I'm finding very little daylight between us. I think we entirely agree on this. And I guess my question is, well, George Bush ran for office saying that he opposed nation building. He changed his mind after September 11th. And again, I supported the war in Afghanistan from the get-go. I didn't support the war in Iraq, but I certainly felt we needed to, you know, get al-Qaeda and get the Taliban. But once we did that pretty much within a year of our invasion. What's fascinating to me is I wonder if you think that most conservatives, like yourself, that did not support nation building, went ahead and supported the president in Afghanistan and Iraq after the initial year, where I think most Americans were agreed, but simply because he was the president and he was a conservative and he was a Republican. I didn't hear many Republicans. I mean, Ron Paul, but he's a libertarian. He was an exception. Most Republicans did not question us going into Iraq, and most Republicans today still support us being in Afghanistan. Do you think you're an outlier from other conservatives on this issue?
To some extent, but I'm going to put it this way. I am a Tea Party member. The Tea Party was formed primarily by people that were tired of the Republican response. For my answer to all the people that have always said, well, this is Bush's fault, the economy is good, look what happened under so many years of Bush, and blah, blah, blah. My answer has always been, I agree with that, but in my opinion, he governed like a Democrat. And that's my argument. So I'm part of the Tea Party. I think most of the people in the Tea Party didn't want a Republican talking right, but then governing to the left. I don't remember any program that was diminished under Bush.
It's interesting. Very interesting.
A lot of people that are going to look at what's the alternative to George Bush, and the alternative domestically with President Obama to a George Bush, I once heard Newt Gingrich say, one is the party of tax and spend, and the other is the party of spend. Well, that's why the Tea Party was formed. We're tired of both.
You made a nice segue to domestic issues, which befits a Tea Party member, because I think you and I can agree the Tea Party really doesn't have a strong position on foreign affairs. At least I haven't heard one. They are primarily about domestic issues. I think it's interesting, though, that when you say that George Bush was a big spender, that was somehow a left issue. I worked in Congress during those years, and I can tell you that we Democrats were always the fiscal conservatives. We opposed the corporate welfare for the oil companies. We opposed the corporate welfare for the pharmaceutical companies. We opposed the massive tax cuts that led to this great deficits that we have. It was the Democrats that supported pay-as-you-go, the idea that if you're going to increase the deficit, you got to find some way to fix it. So it's you assume that somehow deficits are something that the left supports. I assure you, we were fiscal conservatives. I think the real situation is not that the Republicans are fiscal conservatives and the Democrats aren't. As I said, when Bush was president, we were the fiscal conservatives. George Bush was the big spender. What I really think it is that whoever's in power wants to spend. When the Republicans are in power, they want to spend on what they want to spend on, whether it's corporate welfare, pharmaceutical companies, oil companies, or war. That's their priorities. They want to spend. When the Democrats are in power, I admit, we want to spend. We want to spend on health care, education, Pell Grants for students, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. We have different things we want to spend on, to be sure, but I would argue that both parties like to spend. They just have different priorities.
And I will... and again, I'm going to wind up agreeing with you.
Wow.
Because the Bush administration spent like drunken sailors.
They certainly did.
And programs grew. No department got smaller. That doesn't mean that I agree one iota when the left does it or when President Obama does it.
Well, I respect your consistency.
I think we need a balanced budget amendment, or we get what you just spoke of a minute ago was rhetorical, but it never actually happened. There's a lot of rhetoric about pay-as-you-go, but it didn't really happen.
Well, I respect your consistency. I would just remind you that at that period in time, the Democrats were opposed to the big spending. The Republicans supported the big spending. Not that the Democrats didn't support big spending later on, but I do respect your consistency. I would just argue don't call big spending a liberal idea. Just call it big spending, and then you and I can agree 100% of the time. Thanks so much for your call, William.
If you and I agree on a balanced budget amendment,
well, no, I'll tell you why I don't agree. You know what? Stick around with me, William. I got to take a break. I have no choice in the matter. But stick around with me. I'm going to tell you why I don't agree with the budget, balanced budget amendment, but it may be for a different reason than you think. It's not because I love spending. Stick around with me, William, will you? If you want to call in and join this discussion, you can. William has done a nice segue from foreign policy to domestic policy, and I'm going there with him. 888-653-7543. Back after this. Welcome back. This is Mark Levine. And I got a really good caller on the line, I got to say. I like William from Chicago. He is a conservative, and I am a liberal. But, actually, we're finding a lot of agreement tonight. And William has sort of changed the topic. But you know what? I think it's okay because I think it's a good discussion. We were talking about bin Laden. I'll get back, I promise, to the things that helped us capture him and to discussion on torture and discussion on whether the war should be over. I promise. I'll get onto that next hour. But William was talking about domestic policy, usually I don't like people go off topic, but you know what? I agree with, I'm glad William went there because this is something that conservatives say a lot. So William has agreed with me, and I'm glad he has, because it's a fact, that Bush way overspent in the O's, and I reminded him that when I worked in Congress, which was 2001 to 2003, we were trying very much to defend the Clinton surpluses. In fact, I remember, personally, I remember Alan Greenspan appearing before Congress and arguing that Clinton surpluses were devastating to America because they were going to grow so high that soon, in just a couple years, just a few years, we would pay off the entire national debt, and then where would we put the money? Apparently, it never occurred to Alan Greenspan to put it in IOUs for Medicare or for Social Security or to give it back to the people. And because of that, we've got to have this massive Bush tax cut. Alan Greenspan has since apologized for that. I thought it was silly at the time he said it. But William then goes on to say, well, Mark, would you support a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution? And I would not. And I want to tell William why, and I want to give him a chance to respond because he's been very nice to listen to me, and I want to listen to him. The reason I don't support a balanced budget amendment is because in my mind, there's two issues when it comes to spending. One is where you spend. And as the point I made before, obviously Democrats, Republicans have different priorities. Republicans' priorities, giving money to very rich people, giving money to oil companies, giving money to pharmaceutical companies, fighting various wars, that tends to be Republican priorities. Democratic priorities tend to be health care and education and Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and those priorities. So one is where the money goes. You'll note that the Republicans were working very hard to defund Planned Parenthood and NPR, but still wanted to give subsidies to rich farmers that were way above that amount. So where you spend is certainly important. But William raises the question of how much you spend. And I supported surpluses in the Clinton years, and yet I support deficits in the Obama years. Now, one could say, well, Mark, you're a hypocrite. You're inconsistent. How could you support surpluses in the Clinton years? And I supported surpluses in the Bush years, too, by the way. But support deficits in the Obama years. And the reason is because in bad times, I believe partly because I have a degree in economics, where I studied under actually Ronald Reagan's chief economic advisor, Martin Feldstein, was my professor and my thesis advisor, because I understand that in bad times, you need to spend money. Now, in good times, you have to save money. That's why I supported surplus in the Clinton years. That's why I was a fiscal conservative in the Bush years. You can hear me on air if you go back to my old radio shows in 03 and 04 and 05 and 06 and 07, strongly arguing for fiscal conservatism against George W. Bush. But when we were hit with the recession, I know my economic history. I know what happened in 1929. I know that it was a fairly minor recession after Black Friday, after the stock market fell in October 1929. And Herbert Hoover used what was then classical economics to say, now's the time to balance the budget. And what did he do? He raised taxes, he cut spending, he tried to cut the deficit, and he turned a recession into the Great Depression. Whereas Franklin Roosevelt spent money we didn't have, borrowed money, brought out the Works Progress Administration. Frankly, the biggest spending binge was in the 1940s. World War II was a massive spending binge. We actually spent more than our entire gross domestic product, 130, 140%. And between the New Deal and World War II, we came roaring out of the Great Depression. So I will say, William, I do believe if unemployment is below, let's say, 5%, and you want to say that when unemployment is below 5%, that you want to insist on a balanced budget, I agree. In fact, I think we should have a surplus at that time. But I still want to have the freedom to stimulate the economy in the event of a recession. So, William, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is probably going to sound remarkable to you. Let me first say, I don't call the time between the New Deal and coming out of World War II roaring out of a recession. I call that a relatively set time span, and that's not a short time span. But having said that, it was Ronald Reagan himself that made Margaret Thatcher very nervous because he at the time endorsed some amount of deficit spending. His was aimed more at the military, but he actually endorsed that. So I don't disagree that there are sometimes purposes that can be not served otherwise. If you're about to go into war, you've got to prepare for it. You can't wait until you've got cash on hand necessarily to build planes and that sort of thing, or bombs. But having said that, I'm more concerned with what you're spending the money on than that it needs to be spent. And
that's the basic conservative liberal difference.
When Bush, in my opinion, bribed Congress to get the amendment through to do the first stimulus bill and pay off the banks and that sort of thing, I thought that was abominable. And I didn't think it was any better done or any more efficiently done when President Obama did the same bribing process for health care. If you want to argue the merits of those two plans, I could argue the merits. But the method and the bribery and all that went through, that's American money that's being wasted. There's no
justification
for that.
It's interesting. What you're talking about, of course, is the legislative give and take that has occurred really since the founding of this country. Actually, it goes back to the states even before. You can go back to any democracy, and you find that legislators say, well, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. All right, give me this that I want, and I'll give you that I want. It's unseemly, to be sure. But to me, that's not so much bribery. I mean, a legislator says, hey, I really care about this thing. You really care about that thing. I'll vote for A if you vote for B. That, to me, it's out in the open. That, to me, is far less unseemly and far less bribery than having very rich corporate interests under the table, undisclosed, give millions and tens of millions of dollars to presidential candidates to give them money in the back. I mean, that when you have a corporation give a candidate $1 million and saying, hey, and you're going to support me that tax break that gives me $100 million, to me, that is far more bribery than the things that you complain of. You agree?
Well, the point is, it's no more under the table for a union than it is for a corporation. I agree with both of them. I want it out. I don't want that part of the legislative process. But that's my problem with when you give too much money to children to spend.
And do you support public financing of campaigns?
Tax and spend, but we don't really do that. We spend, and then up comes the debt ceiling argument of, well, we must raise taxes to avoid the nation collapsing.
Our spending is pretty much in line with the past. If you look at the actual spending, the vast majority of the spending is programs that were started by George Bush. That's where our deficit mostly comes from. Most of Obama's spending were temporary things like the stimulus package. And we're spending at about the level we've always spent for the last 60 years. What's different is that our tax receipts are the lowest they've been since 1950. So maybe that's where you want to go. But I got to tell you, we have a very different world. We have troops all over the world now. So I would argue to you that it's not the spending that's out of line with the history. It's actually the taxes. But thanks for your call, William. If you want to stay on the next hour, you're welcome to. Otherwise, we will take more of your calls. 888-653-7543. I appreciate it. That was a really nice dialogue. We'll be right back. This is Mark Levine at the top of the hour after this. Welcome back. I'm your host tonight, Mark Levine, talking about Bin Laden. Okay, everyone's been talking about Bin Laden for the last 5 days. Can you blame us? It's just sometimes you just sit back and you think, wow, wow. I mean, we did it. America did it. Our Navy SEALs did it. Our military did it. Our president did it. Our intelligence did it. Intelligence did it. Sometimes justice is done. But when the celebration winds down a bit, it's important to realize why we did it. How do we succeed? What went right and what went wrong before? Why did it take us 10 years, almost 10 years, to capture the murderer of 3,000 Americans? It's interesting. I've been reading the Leslie's Facebook page. You're welcome to join in there. You're also welcome to call in, of course, 888-653-7543. Got a great call from William in the last hour. He thanks me for his civility. I think you'll find if you're a conservative, if you treat me with civility, I will always treat you with civility. If you insult me, I'll probably insult you back. That's just how it goes. But there is a guy who writes, and I don't know whether to say his name on air or not. I'll just say Lou. I won't say his last name. I don't know whether he wants that or not. He wrote on Leslie's Facebook page, so that's pretty public. But Lou writes that Obama is the cowboy president, not Bush. Obama violated Pakistani sovereignty.
What?
Yeah, that's what he argues. It's right there on Leslie's Facebook page. He says, Bush wouldn't violate Pakistani sovereignty. Bush respected international law and treaties, and Obama's the cowboy. He says that the left cries that Bush lied to the United Nations, lied to Congress, lied to the American people about Iraqi WMDs, but Obama violates the sovereignty of an allied nation by dropping bombs and missiles and sending a strike force for assassination without permission. Well, Lou, let me respond. This is an easy one. And you're welcome to call in, Lou. Seriously, you want to call in, I want to hear from you. 888-653-7543. I'd love to hear your rationale. Let's talk about the differences. First of all, Bush's lies. Bush, I don't care if Bush lies to the Pakistanis. Bush lied to us. He lied to the American people. He told us there were weapons of mass destruction when he knew there were not. He got us into a war that cost us thousands of American lives and literally trillions of dollars. It's a major part of the deficit that Republicans now complain about. And hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. For a mistake. Wasn't a mistake. For a lie. For a mistake would be bad enough. It would be horribly negligent. For a lie, I just think that's unforgivable. He lied because, let's face it, we now know January 30th, 2001, he was dividing up the Iraqi oil fields. He had planned to invade Iraq for a very long time. And if he said that, you know, I want to invade Iraq because it's got great oil, then do that. Get the votes, be honest about it, I'd oppose it, and we'd move on. But he lied to us. And he did break international law. Because this wasn't a war of self-defense. United Nations Charter says you have a right to self-defense. It wasn't a war to prevent genocide. There are international treaties against genocide where you can take action. That's how I justify the Libyan war, by the way. No, it would It was just a, it was a pure colonial war. And we, and the worst part is we didn't even get much oil out of it. I mean, at least, this is where, oh my God, I can't believe I'm agreeing with Donald Trump. But if we were going to invade Iraq for oil, at least get the damn oil, right? Now compare that to Barack Obama. Louis, I know you're really concerned about Pakistani sovereignty. I mean, I don't know whether you just said that to be provocative or you really are concerned. Let me tell you why what Barack Obama did was 100% legal under international law and not just because it was the right thing to do. First, let me tell you why it was right under American law. George Bush lied to get us into a war. Just the way, I mean, he isn't the first president to do this, by the way. Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, lied to get us in the Vietnam War. In 1898, the Hearst newspapers lied about the Maine blowing up in the Philippines. It was actually a boiler that destroyed the Maine. But remember, the Maine became the cry for the Spanish-American War of 1898. Okay, so Bush isn't the first president to lie to get us into a war. I accept that. But still, lying to get us into war is a pretty major thing considering how many people died and how much money was spent, how many lives were lost, how many people are walking around with artificial limbs because Bush lied. Frankly, I don't believe the American people would ever have supported a war in Iraq if it weren't for the lie about weapons of mass destruction. That's why they created that lie. I don't think American people would have said, let's go invade Iraq and lose thousands of lives just to get some oil. I don't think so. But now, what did Obama do? First of all, he never lied to us. He told us before the election. I remember that debate with John McCain. Remember, I think it was the second debate. It's the one where they were walking around with the town hall. You don't believe me? Look it up. I'm sure it's on YouTube. Right? Watch that second debate. He said very clearly, if I have actionable intelligence that Barack Obama... I can't believe I did it myself. That's embarrassing. If I have actionable intelligence that Osama bin Laden is located in Pakistan and we can take him out, I will do so. And McCain said, no, I won't do so. I'm not going to violate Pakistani sovereignty. McCain had the same idea that George Bush had at Tora Bora. Let the people themselves get him. We saw how well that worked at Tora Bora. George Bush was wrong. John McCain was wrong. They were wrong as a matter of strategy, and they're definitely wrong as a matter of law, because you have a right to self-defense. Now, you're right, Lou, that in a functional country, the right thing to do is to first get that country to help you. Let's say we knew of a terrorist in Britain. We actually had a terrorist in Italy. You know, the guy that attacked the Achille Lauro. Remember that? It was part of the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and they took an elderly American man, Leon Klinghoffer, and they pushed him off his wheelchair into the ocean. Remember that brutal thing? He actually escaped to Italy, and we demanded Italy turn him over. Actually, Italy didn't turn him over. But Italy, and I strongly disagree with that decision, but Italy is a functioning democracy. If a terrorist goes to England or France or Canada, we're going to ask that they turn them over. That's the right thing to do under international law. We had asked Pakistan for 10 years to turn over Osama bin Laden. They said, well, we don't know where he is. What happened at Tora Bora? The Pakistanis, he got through. Let's face it, the Pakistani secret intelligence, it's no secret that the ISI has supported the Taliban throughout much of their existence. As somehow it was seen as a counterweight to India. Pakistan had its own reasons. Pakistan is, as Hillary Clinton put it recently, it's a complex relationship. And it is. I'm not saying they're our enemy, but I'm not saying they're our ally either. They have different interests from us. Barack Obama knew the only way to get Osama bin Laden was to do it ourselves. You want something right, you do it yourself. Bush didn't learn that at Tora Bora. John McCain didn't learn that at Tora Bora, or even in the subsequent years when we were focused on Iraq instead of Afghanistan. Obama learned his lesson. That is what a leader does. See, I don't believe a leader is someone who says, I'm always right, and I'm always going to go in one direction, and I'm not going to let any information change my mind. You could argue that's a leader. It's also the kind of person who would lead you off a cliff. I think a real leader weighs the evidence and learns from the past. That's a good leader. And doesn't necessarily do the same thing that worked in the past. that did not work in the past, I should say. And it didn't work in the past. Did it violate Pakistani sovereignty? If you believe that Pakistan is a functioning nation, remember, the Taliban occupied a whole area of the Swat Valley of Pakistan for several months. To me, that's not a functioning nation. If you believe Pakistan's a functioning nation that would have turned over Osama bin Laden if we had kindly asked for him, if you believe that, Lou, all right, we violated Pakistani sovereignty. I don't think you believe that. I know I don't believe that. I don't know anyone that does believe that. Does John McCain believe that? Did George Bush believe that? Pakistan is not England. It's not France. It's not Canada. Had we done it your way, Lou, I'm confident we would have yet again lost Osama bin Laden. I'm also confident it was perfectly legal under international law. It's perfectly legal under self-defense. Bin Laden murdered 3,000 Americans. We had the right to get him back. We had the right to go in there and get him back. Now, that's different from going in and, you know, taking some of the Chinese Muslims called Uyghurs and rounding them up and bringing them to Guantanamo Bay who had nothing to do with terrorism. That's not legal. That's very different. But absolutely, we have a right to do that to bin Laden. Absolutely. When we come back, I want to go to the next question. I want to talk about, we've talked about the past a lot. I want to talk about the future. Does it mean that we should now pull out of Afghanistan? Now that we got bin Laden? I think we should. I think it's time to come home. I think the mission is largely accomplished. What do you think? 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mark Levine. Okay, so we did it. We got bin Laden. We did it through the right technique. I firmly support the way the president did it. Now what's next? What's next? I argue this is a mission accomplished moment, and I think it's time to go home. Now, I'm not saying withdraw our troops tomorrow, but I think over the next year, I don't see why we can't withdraw 80 to 90% of our troops in Afghanistan. We don't need to do nation building. William, the conservative from Chicago, agrees with me on this one. We have accomplished our task. We can use all that wonderful intelligence that we got because President Obama made the right decision to go in with SEALs, even though it was dangerous, even though it was risky, even though it was near the Pakistani military base. By going in with individuals, we collected apparently a treasure trove of intelligence. Let's go through it. While we're in Afghanistan, let's take out every Al-Qaeda person we can. And 6 months, a year from now, I don't see why we can't start the drawdown in December. And by December 2012, by the presidential election, we should be mostly out of Afghanistan. All right, Betty from Houghton Lake, Michigan, what do you think?
Complete agreement with you. Bring them home, let them get rested up, let them go to the cemetery to mourn over the loved ones that lost while they were over there serving our country in another country, and let them prepare for this imminent attack. We don't know if it's a year from now that these people, this Al-Qaeda is going to strike. We don't know what's going to go on. We need them home. They don't want to be over there. They aren't wanted over there. And I think we could do more if we could bring our guys home. And may I say something about,
sure.
I know you're talking about the future, but may I say something in reference to the past?
Sure. We've been talking about it for the last 2 hours. Go right ahead.
Okay, and 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, President Bush, I remember when he was up in front of the cameras and he was talking, and one of the reporters had mentioned about the special ops. Why don't we put in special ops? And
right.
He said he has full, belief in our troops. Yes, that is so, but when you can use little first, why not go in with the little before the more? And another thing about this operation that President Obama just done, consider this. There is very little monetary damage. What do we got to go in? Fix up a mansion next to a base to repair the damage that we've done to get this guy versus a city and town?
I don't think we have to repair it at all, actually. But
exactly.
but here's the thing.
And
you know,
to pay for the trash pickup on the helicopter they had explode. I mean, God was with us on this one, and I really think they should bring our troops home. I truly do.
I'll tell you something, Betty. You know, when there's a fly in your house. I don't know about you. I use a fly swatter. I don't use a bazooka.
No.
And we were out to get one man, a dangerous, evil man, to be sure. I mean, I wouldn't have taken one special ops in. We apparently, there's about 40 and three helicopters. Okay, you know, enough force. But there are things, if you're fighting a military, you need a military. If you're fighting a lone evil man, you need some very, very smart people who can pursue intelligence and pursue leads and then go in and take him out. And you're absolutely right. I got to tell you who has this strategy, who's had this strategy for years. It's Vice President Joe Biden. I remember talking with him when he was Senator Biden back in about 05, 06 at a radio convention. And Senator Biden, then Senator Biden, said to me, we don't have to occupy every single town in Afghanistan. When we see the terrorists, we take them out. We do pinpoint. We bomb them. Maybe even we go in with troops, but we don't have to occupy the entire land to do that. It's a lot cheaper. It risks a lot less lives. It costs a lot less money. And the answer is, and I'm talking about someone who supported the war in Afghanistan. I mean, I was against the war in Iraq, but I supported the war in Afghanistan from the get-go. I really did. In fact, I wanted a formal declaration of war. I was in Congress, and I wanted that because I was so angry about September 11th. But after 6 months, after a year, after the Taliban was no longer in power, then I think we have a small footprint. Like I said, I actually don't agree with taking 100% of the troops home. I think take 80 or 90%, lower it down to about 10,000, and have just enough around to watch and keep our eyes open, and if we see stuff happening again, go in again. But this right. idea that we have to occupy every town, that in this country where there's 15% literacy, Betty.
I know.
85% of the people can't read. You know, I feel bad for them, but I just don't think that we have the power. I mean, if we're going to do that, then why not Yemen? Why not Somalia? Why not most of Africa? Why not virtually every, you know, third world country on earth? So I No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I hear a lot of times people talk on the radio, well, we'll show them our power. Well, we showed them our power. And that's not going to stop them from attacking anybody throughout the world, where even where our Americans are tourists. It doesn't matter. These people know we have the power, and they do not fear us, okay? They have learned to go underground, to infiltrate, and that's exactly what we did with the special ops. We
that's
basically
right.
infiltrated with the small, not being noticed. The shock and awe cost us trillions or billions, whatever it costs. It was ridiculous to go through and put, and I, when I meet soldiers, I always tell them, God bless you, and I always thank them, and I always tell them, I'm so sorry that you even had to go through. And you know what I've always been told over the many years? We should have went to Afghanistan and went there first. We should have not even have bothered with Hussein. He was small
that's
potatoes
right.
compared to what was going to be done. And that's our soldiers. That's our foot soldiers. I mean, that's our, I mean, geez, oh, Petey. You
know,
and as far as the waterboarding, I was listening to an ex-ranger on the radio.
Betty, I want to talk to you about waterboarding. I really do. We got to take a break here, but if you'll stay on the line, I want to get that, because that actually brings me up to my next issue, which is about the torture. So it's a great segue for you. Hang on with me. If you want to join this discussion, you can too. The toll-free number is 888-653-7543. Betty's absolutely right. You know, sometimes brawn is necessary, and sometimes it's brains. Sometimes we can do more with smarts than we can with force. And that's what I think Obama showed. A small, well-trained force of special ops can sometimes do things an entire army can't do. That's no disrespect to the army. It's just the wrong tool for the job. Betty, I'll be back with you and other callers after this. A lot of interesting discussion. I know I'm going to try to get to Betty, Fred, and Alex about whether or not to bring our troops home. I want to finish with Betty, though. I had to cut her off because of the break. Betty, you were talking about something about torture, I believe.
Yes, the waterboarding. I was listening.
Right.
I leave my radio on 24/7 for talk radio to hear everyone. And I heard a retired ranger on one station being interviewed and a retired SEAL being interviewed. So forgive me, I don't remember their names or which one spoke this. But they made a remark, and I think it was the ranger, said, a lot of people in our country do not know that when we go through special trainings, I guess it's special units, I don't know if they go through this when they first go through basic. I have no idea. But I think it was more or less for the more special training that they go through water, they torture here. I mean, they do the waterboarding to our guys to train them so they know what to expect if it's
right.
done to them.
Right.
And it's more of a psychological torture because they think they're going to die due to drowning. It's not a physical abuse like Senator McCain or anyone else that's gone through the camps to Japan or whoever tortured back in World War II, you know. So if the waterboarding, I'm in agreement with.
Oh, well, okay.
I can go along with it because, like I said, it's a psychological. They think they're
I'll tell you this, Betty.
You have they're near a hospital and they have a doctor and facilities and everything else to make sure. And another thing they made a remark was the 188 times that this particular person, or when they did the waterboarding, it was actually three different times they waterboard. I mean, three different
people
that it happened. That a total of they were splashed 188 times with the
right.
water.
Right, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Well, it went. You know, splashed is a little bit. That's. I think that makes a little bit light of it. I mean,
please forgive me for saying this, but it's better than putting an electrical charge to someone's.
But Betty, here's the thing. Here's the thing.
You know what I'm trying to say?
No. I know what you're trying to say. But hold on, Betty.
Going on. So the waterboarding, I can handle that one.
Well, let me talk to you about this, and then I really want to get to Fred and Alex, who will hang on. But first of all, to say it's splashing, I mean it's to the extent that
I understand
you can't breathe. You can't breathe, and if you make a mistake, the person dies. It's kind of like holding someone's head underwater and then letting them up at the right time. Now, you know, maybe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed knew we wouldn't kill him, but if that's true, then 188 times seems to me are no more effective than two or three. The question is not, by the way, we also did other things. We beat people. We banged them into walls. We forced them in stress positions. We didn't let them eat. We put them nude in cold places. So there's all kinds of torture, not just waterboarding. But the heart of the question to me, Betty, there's two questions. One, is it legal? And two, does it work? Now, on the question of legality, it's very clear that it is illegal. It's not just that the Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment, but we also have signed Geneva Conventions, which very clearly laid out our treaty obligations. And the Constitution says any treaties we sign have the force of law. So what we did was illegal. And then there's the question of morality, and I'll get to the question of whether it works in a minute, but there's a question of morality. Do we want to be seen as a nation who tortures? Do we want to have the same tactics the terrorists do? For example, let's say that if you tortured someone's child, they would talk. Or if you raped someone, they would talk. Where does it stop? Where do we no longer become just like our enemies? That's the moral question.
Exactly.
And then there's the practical question. And this is the one that I start with because we can have long debates about the morality of it. I think, frankly, it's clearly illegal, but we can have debates about the legality. Let's talk about the practicality of it. The two people we tortured, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Al-Libi, lied to us about this courier who led us to bin Laden. The guy who told us the truth, a guy by the name of Hassan Ghul, was not waterboarded. So what I think you'll find is that when people are being tortured, what are they going to do? If I were being tortured, I have to tell you, I think I would tell the people who tortured me anything they wanted to hear just to make the torture stop. I'd tell truth. Yes. I'd tell lies. I'd tell them anything, just make it stop, right? Yeah. I don't think it's that effective. One of the best effective techniques that I've understood from investigators, and not just counterterrorism investigators, but even the good old police force, it's deception. You trick people. I remember that there were two people on September 11th that dressed up as Saudi, and they looked Saudi. They were Americans, but they spoke Arabic with a Saudi accent. They wore the robes. They came into a hospital with a terrorist leader, and they started talking to him. And he said, well, you know, I mean, that's, you knew all about 9/11. And the Saudis said, what are you talking about? Well, Prince Ahmed, and there was a prince in Saudi Arabia who apparently was all knew about 9/11. We got this information out by deception. And if you can get this out by deception, I have no problem with that. To me, it puts us in a different class. And I think it's fascinating. If torture had really worked, I think George Bush would have gotten Osama bin Laden in 02 and 03 and 04. I don't think that – so I don't think it's practical. I don't think it's moral. And I don't think it's
legal. Thank you. Thank you for correcting my thinking.
You don't have to agree with me. You're welcome to disagree.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Because if we start there, then what starts with
when do
our
we stop?
Morality? Do we start going downhill there from there? I stand corrected on it. But I was just, I mean, a lot of people were upset about it, and I thought, well, if that's all they did, I mean, I understand that they did put the clothing on and all that. But if it was, if they were complaining only about the waterboarding compared to some of the other torturing techniques,
Yeah. Here's the thing. Here's the thing. You know, they talk about it as the Jack Bauer moment. Everyone saw 24, the idea that you have a ticking time bomb and that you need it to. But this, of course, was not a ticking time bomb moment. This was careful, intricate, detailed, mind-boggling detective work that got Osama bin Laden. And we may always have this argument about torture. I actually like Alan Dershowitz's argument, which is if we're going to torture, we should pass a law that permits it, because right now it's illegal, pass a law that permits it, have only the president be able to sign on to it, and make that president sign a specific order authorizing that torture, and so that the historic record knows it, so that it can't be, in other words, if we're going to do it, make it legal and don't let it be abused. I don't think we should ever do it. But at the very least, I don't think the president should break the law. And that's my real problem. All right. Thank you for your call. I appreciate that. I really do.
Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much. You have a good evening. I love the show. Great.
Thanks. Thanks. Keep listening in. And by the way, you can Facebook me, Mark Levine, M-A-R-K-L-E-V-I-N-E. You can join my fan page. I do shows other than this one. And you can, even if you're not in Washington, D.C., you can check that out as well. I want to read you a comment before I get, and I'm going to get to Fred and Alex, I promise. But I just want to read you a comment by Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who's a Republican who I often disagree with. But he writes, quote, "This idea we caught bin Laden because of waterboarding is a misstatement," unquote. Quote, "I do not think this is a time for celebrating waterboarding. The problems at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib caused us great misery, and it was a recruiting tool," unquote. And that's another thing. If we torture people, that it is often used as a recruiting tool. See, the Americans, they're miserable. They do attach electrodes to whatever Betty was talking about, to private parts, and they're terrible people. Come join the fight against America. Let me, you know, I'll tell you something. That story, it's always fascinated me. There's no one I have less sympathy for than Nazis, all right? I mean, I have no sympathy for Osama bin Laden. People who worked in the death camps, I can't think of, frankly, a greater evil. I just can't think of a greater evil. That's the lowest of the low. And yet, when the United States took German prisoners of war, Nazi prisoners of war, SS, after the firefight was over, when we took them, we treated them humanely. And I got to tell you, my gut says that's wrong. My gut says, oh my God, these were vicious, awful, terrible people. Many of them were mass murderers, and obviously we did the Nuremberg trials, and we did execute a few of the worst of them. But for the average German soldier, even some of the Nazis, we treated them humanely. And they went back to Germany. And again, my gut tells me it was wrong, but my mind studies this and learns what happened afterwards. They went back to Germany. They said, the Americans are humane. We were wrong to support the Nazis. It opened their eyes. Many of them turned away. Germany, of course, is a very positive, democratic, progressive nation. There's very few Nazis left in Germany. By treating these evil people with kindness, we actually defeated the evil. I mean, isn't that what Jesus was talking about when he said, turn the other cheek? I'm not saying it out of religion. I'm not Christian. I'm saying it out of practicality. It turns out that sometimes, I'm not saying Osama bin Laden, right? Okay, Osama bin Laden deserved his execution. Hitler deserved execution. But when it comes to the foot soldiers, not the leaders, sometimes you treat evil with kindness and it turns around. It's amazing, really. All right, I'm going to get to both Fred and Alex. I promise when we come back, 888-653-7543, right back after this. Welcome back to the show. Got time for two more callers. The question is that now that we got bin Laden, should our troops come home from Afghanistan? Fred in Chicago, welcome to the show.
Mark. Hi, Mark. I agree with you totally. First of all, I think we should get out as fast as we can. But this is what I'm worried about, and I wonder if this is one of the reasons why they're thinking twice about getting out so fast. I think it's economic, political reasons. Okay, if everybody gets out of Afghanistan, if we get all our troops home, I think they're worried about, number one, jobs. Is this going to unemployment? I hate to think this way, believe me, because I want everybody out of Iraq and Afghanistan. But believe me, I think that's one of the backlash things that this could happen. And there's precedent that this happened before. When George Bush, the father, went into Iraq or Kuwait to get Iraqis out of there, his approval ratings were great. I mean, we were doing great. It wasn't a long mission or nothing, but when the troops came back, unemployment went through the roof, and then he lost to President Clinton. So I'm just
wondering. I've never heard that theory before.
I think that's not the reason, but, you know, I'm just wondering if it's the economic thing about how America would with the jobless rate or whatever. I don't know how to put it.
Let me give you another example from history, and that is after a much longer war and a much greater troop mobilization, World War II. When our troops came home from World War II, Harry Truman and the Democratic Congress had the idea of a GI Bill, recognizing they couldn't all find jobs right away. He said, you've served your country well. You get a free education. You get to go to college. And, well, servicemen and women, mostly men, signed up in the millions. And, in fact, brought us the incredible economic decade of the 1950s, the single best economic decade until, well, Bill Clinton's decade, the 1990s. I think that, here's the thing. One of the government spending stimulates the economy, and it doesn't matter whether we're paying for soldiers or we're paying for their education. When people have more money in their pockets, it creates demand and it stimulates the economy. Now, I hear what you're saying. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, Fred. But I'll tell you this. It's cheaper to fund a serviceman's education or to have them stateside than it is to fund the body armor and the tanks and the replace the drone missiles. Frankly, it's a lot more expensive to build a bridge in Afghanistan than in the United States. It's also a lot more helpful to those of us in the United States. So I think that if we don't cut them off, we don't bring them home and say good luck, as we did, unfortunately, to some of our people in Vietnam when we had another depression in the 70s, right, when all they came home. If we look at the model not of the 70s and not of the not of 91, which is the model you talk about, but look at the model of the late 40s and 50s when we had a terrific economy, the model is you keep up the spending. Remember, Dwight Eisenhower taxed rich Americans at the highest tax rate, more than 90%. It's inconceivable how much that Republican taxed people in those days. But because he kept our government spending, we had a roaring 1950s and not the recession that we had. What do you think?
Mark, I agree with you. The whole key is we have to tax the high-income people more than we're taxing them. This is ridiculous.
Right. Okay, I wouldn't advocate 90. I mean, that's what Eisenhower did. But I think back in the Clinton era of about 40% seems about right.
Definitely. We're never going to get out of the hole if we don't. And yeah, and they're only kidding themselves if people don't think that the rich have to be taxed. Even these oil companies that are getting away with murder. It's ridiculous.
I'll tell you something. That's another issue that next time I host for Leslie, I promise I will get into oil companies because I want to get into their taxes, what they're not paying, and all the corporate welfare we give them. But I want to get a chance to get Alex on this issue before my time ends. So thanks very much, Fred. I appreciate your call. Alex, you've been hanging on a while. What are your thoughts about our troops coming home?
I think that actually maybe pulling some of them back, but I think we should stay. And I think the scare is what has happened in the past is that history repeats itself. And the one thing that we've learned is that these terrorists are bred by us destroying infrastructure, going in there and trying to do what we do as a country in our best interest, and destroying their country and leaving them high and dry. And then some nut job comes around and says, hey, look what they did. And that's basically how World War II even came about, if you think about the history of it.
About the Versailles Treaty and all.
If we just pull our troops out and leave them high and dry, who's to say that there's not some other terrorist group that's going to come from this, and they're going to point the finger at America again and said, look what they did. And join us, and we can, you know, screw the infidel.
Well, Alex, I wonder if we could come to some agreement, you and me, because I hear what you're saying. One of the reasons why I thought that we were doing the right thing in Libya is because we weren't. Colin Powell famously said, apparently, about the Iraq War and trying to convince George Bush not to do it. He said it's the old Pottery Barn principle, and apparently Pottery Barn doesn't do this, but you break it, you bought it. The idea that, as you said, we leave them high and dry. We destroy their infrastructure. We own them. And I think that is true when you fully occupy a country. That's why I'm usually against full occupation, barring an absolute necessity, like Germany and Japan. What we could do is pinprick. Libya, help no-fly zone. Afghanistan, what we just did with Osama bin Laden. We didn't occupy Pakistan. We were occupied it for 40 minutes, and then we got out of there. So, but now that we have, what you're saying is we broke it, we bought it. I think that you and I maybe can come to some agreement to withdraw a huge amount of troops. I was arguing 80 to 90%, not all. And I'll tell you who I'd like to be there fixing it, not the military. Send the Peace Corps. You know, there's a bunch of Americans that want to help women have an education, want to help build schools, want to help build bridges. And I think sometimes people without guns can actually have more power than people with guns, because just having Americans treat Afghanis right, I think, may do more to prevent terrorism from growing in Afghanistan. And don't get me wrong, if a terrorist comes about, if Al-Qaeda gets more power, you know, go back in. I mean, and I'm not saying go in with troops. I'm not saying go in full invasion, but do what we did with Osama bin Laden. Find them, bomb them. You know, I'm not arguing to remove all our troops. I'm arguing removing 80-90%. But the point is, rather than occupying every land, go where the trouble is. I'm told that there's about 100 Al-Qaeda members in the entire country of Afghanistan, and we have 100,000 troops there. That's 1,000 soldiers for every one terrorist. That doesn't seem to me like a good way to spend money. So I'm not saying leave it completely, and I'm not saying don't help them rebuild, but isn't this a job for the Peace Corps rather than the military?
I think the Peace Corps has a good aspect, but, I mean, I honestly think that the military is more heavily funded at this point, unfortunately, and I don't agree with why it is, but I honestly think that, like, the military engineering division, you know, I know...
Yeah, but Alex, here's the thing. Afghanistan wasn't that so advanced to begin with. You know, you make it sound like Afghanistan had this great functioning country and we broke it and now we have to fix it. It didn't have a functioning country when we went in. So, you know, I don't know how many bridges we destroyed. There aren't that many in Afghanistan, frankly. Their roads aren't that good. There's like a two-lane highway to Pakistan. So, you know, I don't know how much damage we've done there. We've probably done a lot more in Iraq, frankly, because it's a more settled, a more advanced...
You're also downplaying all the casualties on their side, people.
That's true, but what are we going to do about that? I mean, look, I'm not sure what you're proposing. I mean, I feel bad. I mean, obviously, in getting terrorists, we accidentally killed some civilians. I think it's terrible. We go in and we should attend the funerals and we should maybe pay some compensation for the people who die. We do that. But I just don't think that means that we should be occupying Afghanistan for the next 10, 20 years. When does it end, in your view? Does it ever end? Is it like Germany and Japan and South Korea were there forever?
No, I don't. I think there is a breaking point. But I think the thing is that right now the knee-jerk reaction of, okay, we got Osama bin Laden, let's get the hell out now, is wrong. And we don't have – back in September 11th, when we had all the intel in the world about this stuff, and we didn't use it.
Well, let me say this, Alex, because my time is running out, and so you're welcome to call in next time. I'll have more time when I'm on again. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we should stay a little while. We just got all this new intel, as you point out, all this great intel that we got from Osama bin Laden's lair in Pakistan. Let's definitely stay 6 months to a year and get everyone we can with that actionable intelligence. Some of it will be done with a small footprint, just like we did before. We didn't necessarily have to have, you know, a whole army in there. But then I think it's time. At some point, you got to declare victory and leave. And we're not going to have any gun come on a battleship and surrender to us. Now we can start the drawdown. Let people know. Hey, folks, I am Mark Levine. I host a show in Washington, D.C. Called The Raucous Caucus. I host The Inside Scoop. You can find out everything you want to know about me at marklevineradio.com. That's my website. You can Facebook me, too. I've enjoyed it. See you next time.